From Radio 720 WGN Chicago, it's time for Extension 720. Here's your host, Milt Rosenberg.
Good evening, and a cordial welcome to our two very special guests. They are both professors of Byzantine civilization. Dean Miller is Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Rochester. Robert Nelson is Professor of Art History at the University of Chicago. And you both count, do you not, as Byzantinists? Is that the way you say it?
That's close enough.
Yeah. Close enough.
Unless you're English, and then you say Byzantinists.
Byzantinists, right. As they say, aluminium, which is a better word than aluminum.
Right.
I'm going to start in an odd way. You know the answer to this. I doubt that anybody else does who's listening, unless there are other Byzantinists. Why were the rulers of Russia titled Tsar? And what does that have to do with the history of Byzantium?
Well, Tsar is this Slavicized, the Russian form of Caesar. So they simply presumed they could call themselves emperor, but that would have been stretching it, and they didn't do that until much later. But so Caesar or Tsar would have been a reasonable title to pick up.
What does that have to do with Byzantine history?
Well, the whole Eastern Christian world owes its version of Christianity to Constantinople. And through a process of Christianization of the Slavic people, they came to owe first religious and then political allegiance to Constantinople.
And, of course, the emperors of Byzantium consider themselves the emperors of Rome, did they not?
Correct. They actually called themselves Romans.
And they were Caesars.
Yeah. Exactly. They were Caesars.
We need to deal with that, the splitting of the empire into two. It goes way back to the 4th century AD, is that?
The split actually wouldn't occur until late in the 5th century, but by that time Rome did not have an emperor.
Well, I mean the establishment, though, of two emperors and two sections of the Roman Empire.
Well, the emperor in Constantinople would rule the two sections for a time. Then there was a split. And then from that point on until the Roman emperor of Rome disappeared, and then at that point the other was left to take all the marbles.
Who then is the first emperor of the eastern half of the empire?
Well, I would think it would be Constantine the Great, who really unifies the Roman Empire when it had divided itself into this complicated four-part governing arrangement. He moves the capital of the Roman Empire from Rome to Constantinople, to a city, an ancient Greek city that had been called Byzantion. He refounds that city, and it's named after himself, so it becomes Constantinople, Constantine City.
Now, why do they do that? Why do they move from Rome, which, after all, is the center of the Roman Empire?
Why would they do this? Actually, it was to get away from Rome, and specifically, if Constantine had in mind to create a Christian capital, and evidently he did, Rome was pagan, and its spirit was still pagan, and it was still not trusted. And therefore, you move from there to some place that you control completely and build, literally, a culture, a religion, and so on from the ground up.
Constantine, of course, is the author of, or the source of, the Edict of Constantine, which, in fact, permits Christianity in the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm. It makes, for the first time, Christianity is an official religion of the Roman Empire. By the end of the 4th century, it becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire. But Constantine begins this process, and it's an extremely important one for the history of Western civilization.
But is it true, or is it a myth, that Constantine himself does not accept baptism or does not accept and fully enter into Christianity until he's on his deathbed?
That's correct. That's correct. But that was not uncommon, because you wanted to get baptized and completely cleansed from sin.
Uh-huh.
As close to your demise as possible to eliminate the possibility of falling back into sin again. So that, but on the other hand, I do not myself think that he was that convinced a Christian. He had been the sun god. He had been Apollo Helios. There are statues of him that have that appearance, and clearly he was able to use Christianity. But whether he himself was a Christian, and even after his baptism, I'm not sure.
Of course, Rome, the original Rome, and the Italian base of the Roman Empire, is under constant siege and under invasion, suffering invasions from all sorts of peoples, Germanic peoples basically, but yet others, and they really can't maintain themselves very well, can they?
No. And the Byzantines or East Rome helped this out by shifting the invaders westward. The Goths came through and they were bribed and told to go on to Italy where they would find happy hunting. And this occurred in several occasions.
I'm suddenly remembering, just for a modern analogy, though it's, or modern parallel, though it's hardly fully appropriate, East and West Pakistan. When they did the original settlement in India 50 years ago, Pakistan became two countries separated by northern India.
Right.
But it didn't last for long. East Pakistan, of course, broke away, and though it was the lesser half of the two halves of that nation. Mm-hmm. And it is, what's the name of it?
Well, it's Bangladesh.
It's Bangladesh. Right? I was blocking on Bangladesh. But you can't really maintain a country in two separate halves with geographical separation, can you?
Well, the one thing about, if you look at the map of the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, we, in our world, we look at maps and we see land. Mm-hmm. Because we have our interstate highways and we tend to connect via land. They connected via the sea. Mm-hmm. And so, actually, it's not so far from Constantinople to Rome by sea. It looks like quite a significant journey if you were to go all the way around by road, but it's not so far by sea.
Well, then the basic question is, why didn't it hold together, and why didn't the culture persist in the forms of Roman culture with Latin as the basic language, and why, rather, in reality, did Byzantium very quickly become a very different sort of place?
Well, when Constantine moved east, he moved into the whole ecumene, the whole cultural world that was dominated by Greece, or really dominated by Greece after Alexander, which means a different civilization. It means a civilization that managed to spread itself over a vast area, invented a language, a simplified form of Greek to use, tied itself together with trade routes and so on. I mean, the power of Greece was so considerable that even though Rome had conquered that area, it had not conquered it culturally. And he simply moved into a zone that was going to be dominated by Greek culture in some form, what they call the Hellenistic form.
The official fall of Rome, the full sacking by, is it the Goths?
Alaric. Vandals.
The Vandals, rather, yeah. Is in 450-something?
It's in 450s. The last Roman emperor is in 476, so it was...
So from there on, all the Roman action is in Byzantium.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. We have to examine what sort of civilization rose and what sort of empire extended itself over a good portion of the known world in the years from, say, 450 to the fall of Constantinople, 53.
May 29th, 1453.
you were there, were you? In spirit, I guess you were.
In spirit.
Our guests, Dean Miller and Robert Nelson, both of them Byzantionists, and we return to them directly after we pause for these words.
From Radio 720 WGN, this is Extension 720. Here's your host and moderator, Milt Rosenberg.
In a great poem by William Butler Yeats, we have the lines, "And therefore I have sailed the seas and come to the holy city of Byzantium." Let us go to the holy city of Byzantium. And let's go fast forward a bit to, say, the year 550. You've agreed with me during the commercial break, that would be a good place where we might stop and look around and get a sense of what Byzantine life is like, what it's about, for that matter, what it looks like and feels like. It's during the reign of the Emperor Justinian.
It's during the reign of Emperor Justinian, who's really the next great emperor after Constantine the Great in the 4th century. And Justinian greatly enlarges the Byzantine Empire and takes over actually much of what had formerly been the Western Roman Empire, extends the limits all the way to Spain from Constantinople. So the Mediterranean again becomes a Roman lake or a Byzantine lake.
He reconquers a fair amount of Italy itself, doesn't he?
Definitely. And that again becomes a Byzantine province under the general Belisarius.
Yeah. But back at Command Central in Constantinople, what's life like? Suppose we go for a stroll on a nice afternoon in Constantinople at 550. What do we see?
Well, you'll be seeing lots of building, for one thing, since a great deal of A lot of construction activity. No cranes, I suppose, but a lot of construction activity. The great church, Hagia Sophia, was already built.
Mm-hmm.
There's a complete book by the historian Procopius that has to do with what Justinian built. And Procopius claims that Justinian moved around the empire unceasingly, building here, building there, building a new church in Jerusalem, for example, or in Egypt, whatever. Actually, Justinian hardly ever left the capital.
But they controlled all of that. They controlled modern-day Israel. They controlled Egypt.
Yes, the Near East, Egypt. They'd reconquered North Africa from the Vandals. They reconquered at least part of Spain from the Visigoths. And Italy, which would be the most important campaign.
Now, what explains their doing that well in terms of extending the empire? Where'd they get the manpower? Where'd they get the wealth?
Well, actually, Constantine, in moving the capital to the east, moved the capital to what was then and would continue to be the richest part of the Roman Empire. The eastern provinces were quite wealthy and managed to maintain themselves economically during this very serious time of troubles in late antiquity. So that was the wealthiest part of the Roman Empire was in the east.
Anatolia, as long as they held Anatolia, and this would be true right up to when the empire began to have serious problems, I mean, East Rome or Byzantium, if they held Anatolia, they held a reservoir of wealth, cities, manpower.
Anatolia is modern-day Turkey, isn't it?
Yeah, right. That was key. If they held that, then they had the manpower and the resources to do pretty much whatever they could do elsewhere.
But these folks are not Turks.
No. Well, now I tell a lie because some of them would have been Turks. It was a multinational state, Greek speaking, but multinational.
So let's go for our stroll through Constantinople in the month of July, 1550.
550. Well, if you were down at the ports. Constantinople mm-hmm. was a major port city. You might hear, if you were down at the wharves, you, according to one text, would hear 20 different languages spoken.
Mm.
A number of those languages, very obscure. They're utterly dead languages of smaller groups of people in that part of the world. But there's something about Constantinople that's very important to stress, is that it's enormously important geographically. It's a place where all sorts of different lines of communication over land and water come together. And even today in modern-day Istanbul, you see people from Eastern Europe, you see people from the Gulf area, you see people from India coming from tourism, you see all of Western Europe and America. Obviously, America wasn't important in 550, but you have this enormous sort of mix of people. Actually, the Byzantines had a palace guard that consisted of people from Great Britain. The Varangian Guard and also a number of Scandinavians were there present in the city. So it was a very cosmopolitan place. You saw great buildings in Constantinople. You saw arcaded streets. You saw tall columns with statues atop it. You saw a great hippodrome or imperial race course where chariot races took place. And at the center of all this was the Great Palace. Next to it was the Church of Hagia Sophia.
The Great Palace is the modern Topkapi, or is that later?
No. That's the Byzantine Imperial or Great Palace. Oh, very little of it remains, and that does remain is outside the precinct of the Sultan Ahmed, the Blue Mosque.
Uh-huh.
So, and you're not going to tear that down in order to get.
But Hagia Sophia, of course, remains. That's it's now a great mosque. Has been since the Ottoman Turks took.
Right. It was the Cathedral of Constantinople.
Yeah.
And when the Ottomans conquered the city in 1453, they made that church into a mosque and made it into the principal mosque of the Ottoman Empire. And it remained in that status until the 20th century when Ataturk changed Turkey, made the state into a republic, and turned the mosque into a museum. That's its present state. In 550, the church, we know something about it from a description by a contemporary who talks a little bit about the wonders of Saint Sophia. He says, above all rises into the immeasurable air the great helmet of the dome, which bending over like the radiant heavens embraces the church. And at the highest part, at the crown, was depicted the cross, the protector of the city. 1,000 lamps within the temple show their gleaming light, hanging aloft by chains of many windings. Some are placed in the aisles, other in the center and to the west. Thus the night seems to flout the light of the day and to be itself as rosy as the dawn. This great light, he says, shows the way to the living God. Mm. It was quite a miraculous church.
Who is this observer?
This is Paul the Silentiary, who was a church official there in the mid-6th century. There was a problem. Justinian built the church very quickly in the 530s, and it's a great engineering triumph. It was the largest, the highest dome space in the world until the Church of St. Peter's in the Vatican mm-hmm. was built in the completed in the 16th century. And it was a great engineering triumph, but they built too quickly. And they didn't allow enough time for the martyr to set. When you're building in stone, you have to allow time for the martyr between the stones to set. And so they piled on stones above it, and in fact, the great piers of the church began to buckle outward, and so the dome fell down in the middle of the 6th century, and they had to rebuild the dome.
Hmm.
So Paul the Silentiary is talking about the great church after that.
Yeah. I gather it's a place of great controversy. I think of two very different kinds of controversy. You got the equivalent of rioting soccer fans in the great struggles between the Blues and the Greens. That needs to be explained. But you've also got comparable controversies regarding religious tradition and regarding theological interpretation.
Yeah, theological doctrine. Constantine had supposedly settled all problems, and you have, as a proof of this, the Nicene Creed.
Yeah.
And if you repeat that, you get the opinion or the doctrinal opinion mm-hmm. doctrinal opinion of the fourth century
by and the official century. Doctrinal opinion of the contemporary Roman Catholic Church.
Yes, or of any church that regards itself as within that tradition. Correct.
Yeah.
By the sixth century, that had broken mm-hmm. apart, and Justinian did his best to come to some kind of solution, a solution which he as emperor was absolutely within his rights to do, because the emperor was the head of the church. The patriarch was simply a bureaucrat under imperial control. So the emperor had the task of setting these doctrinal questions, and he did his best. I mean, the problem is, I'm not going to say it's a very simple one, but it more or less divides into, was Jesus a man or was he a god?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Nicene Creed says he's both, perfect man and perfect God. Well, that didn't stick very well.
Along comes a monk named Arian.
Arian says...
he argues what?
Well, the Arian position is basically that he's human, more or less disguised as a god.
Perfected human.
Perfected human, disguised as a god. The other position, and I'm getting into areas here that still cause problems.
Yeah.
The other position is basically that... he is a god, and that who takes on the guise of humanity. This is ordinarily called a monophysite position.
Yeah.
What Justinian tried to do was to play with the Greek, and the Greek philosophical vocabulary translated to a theological vocabulary allows you to do all kinds of interesting things.
But there's another element in monophysitism, isn't there, having to do with whether the Holy Spirit emanates from both the Father and the Son, or only from the Father. I don't really understand it, but I know those are the words.
Oh, you're really getting to difficult things here. This tore the Eastern and Western Christian churches apart.
Yeah.
So can you give us a better fix on monophysitism?
Let me say a little bit about this difference in the church, if we can move to that. There was an obscure church council in Spain, I believe, that inserted into the Nicene Creed two words, filioque, which had to do with the procession of the Holy Spirit. In the Nicene Creed, the Spirit comes from the Father, and the Spanish position was that the Spirit would come from the Father and the Son. The Eastern Church refused to accept this interpolation, this insertion into the creed, which became the dogma in the West, and that's still a point of contention.
Still a point
between
of division
Eastern
between
Church.
The two churches.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eastern Church is still monophysite.
No, it's Orthodox.
It's Orthodox. The monophysites were excluded from the church, from the Eastern and Western church, and there are various Christians that more or less subscribe to that position today.
Who does?
The Armenians?
The Armenians,
church?
No, but the Syrian
church.
Yeah, Syrian church.
Right.
The problem is that in addition to it being a theological question, it also, you could say, was almost an ethnic one. And, for example, Syrian Orthodox, not being that fond of the Greeks anyway, mm-hmm. or Egyptian Orthodox, who
That's
now
right,
are the Coptic church. Your Coptic
uh-huh.
church is yeah. Memphisite. Uh-huh. They react to what they would regard as the oppression and control of the Greek hierarchy by maintaining a more Monophysite position and saying, you know, you might think you're right, but actually not only are we right, but we're Egyptian and right or Syrian and right.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an ethnic element that enters into, or national almost, or proto-national.
And at some point there develops what is called the Great Schism between the East, mm-hmm. between the Roman Catholic Church, yeah. based, commanded by the Bishop of Rome, and the Eastern Orthodox tradition, commanded by the Patriarch of Constantinople. When does mm-hmm. that happen?
There's several moments in which the two churches divide or see themselves as different. There's one moment in the 9th century. There's another moment comes in the middle of the 11th century. And for a long time, it looks like one of these sort of fights in a family that breaks out, and everybody thinks that the members of the family will eventually patch it up and it won't have great consequence. But this is one of those fights that they never made up until our century.
They anathematize each other. I've run across that word yeah. in this regard. What does that mean?
Well, anathema, it means you're cast out.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember the exact words of the Patriarch of Constantinople, and he said, I send you down with the devil and his angels, or something like that. It was serious stuff.
And the crucial year there is
1054.
1054, yeah. Right.
Well, I've just been reading. You know,
okay.
This is not in my
That's
head.
That's cheating.
The Pope sends an ambassador to an emissary to Constantinople who marches into the great church, the Church of Hagia Sophia, the Church of St. Sophia, walks right down into the middle of church, walks right up to the altar, and lays down on the altar of the church an excommunication of the Patriarch of Constantinople, which was not taken well by the Patriarch
yeah.
of Constantinople. So this fight really became very serious at that moment.
There's that other big fight that seems to go on at some point and often breaks out anew, namely between different sports factions.
Yes.
That needs to be understood. I'd love to talk with you about that after, once again, a brief pause for some commercials.
From Radio 720 WGN, this is Extension 720. Here's your host, Milt Rosenberg.
And we return to Byzantium, led there by our guides, Dean Miller, who is a professor emeritus of history at Rochester, and Robert S. Nelson, who is professor of art history at the University of Chicago, both of them in their scholarly work, which has been considerable, specializing in Byzantine studies. I wanted us to go to the Hippodrome and to these two sports factions. They really outdo some of the wilder fans at Wrigley Field, don't you think?
Amazingly, in the 6th century, things got out of hand, and the circus factions are the different sort of teams, in a way, if you will. They back different racers in the event.
Chariot racers.
Yeah. They revolted. They rioted. They burned down a good deal of the city. They burned down the previous Church of St. Sophia, and Justinian's rebuilding of St. Sophia took place as a consequence of that riot.
The surging crowd after the Bulls for the first time took the NBA championship.
Right.
That's an equivalent.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or if they
ran down Michigan Avenue and broke a few windows, but
exactly.
These people did much more.
If you've been to a small mm-hmm. Italian town when the soccer team wins and they race through the city, I mean, in our day, the women's soccer team just defeated China, and this mm-hmm. this definitely has political overtones even in our world right now. It was very, very significant at that time politically. Sports was definitely connected with political questions.
It's even older than that in the Roman Empire. They have found posted edicts in stone at Pompeii, haven't they, in which I think it's the Emperor Tiberius, unless it's Nero, who tells them they won't be allowed to have any gladiatorial sport for the next 5 years because they rioted, different factions rioted, after something or other in the stadium at Pompeii.
It's a major, It becomes even more important in society when there aren't other outlets for political dissent.
Mm-hmm.
And in these large public gatherings, if the crowd unites in such a way, there's a riot.
Actually, these factions united and revolted against Justinian himself, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right. And they very, very nearly unseated him or removed him from office. Supposedly, his wife, Theodora, supported him or bucked him up or whatever, saying something like, "What's that the purple is a marvelous winding sheet. I mean, if you die as emperor, that's better than fleeing," and so on. But as I was saying, the hippodrome and the chariot racing there was more than sport, because there was a ritual element, a very powerful ritual element. When the emperor in his imperial box, a place called the kathisma, or the place to sit, literally rose in the east. I mean, it was like the sun looking down on the crowd. And what had to be done after these riots, and was done, was the controlling of these circus factions and turning them into nothing more or less than ritual factions, which is to say, with their behavior very closely circumscribed. They were turned into so-called demes, which is to say, the people. But remember, the Byzantine word democracy meant nothing more nor less than revolution. That's what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
Period. I mean, the idea of rule by the people was simply impossible. So they were very closely controlled and continued to be so.
Why do we use the word Byzantine, usually as an adjective, to connote complexity and secrecy and a certain touch of decadence?
That word, it has that meaning in all the European languages I know. So it's similar meaning in French and German and Italian. The word Byzantine was applied to this civilization for the first time in the 16th century by a German humanist. It becomes connected with the Ottoman Empire in the 17th century, which begins to decline and begins to be seen by Western Europe as corrupt. And so the word Byzantine and the word Ottoman begin to take on this very negative connotation, and it then continues in the 17th, 18th, 19th century down to the present day.
Then it's not really a reference to the empire we're talking about, but to its successor.
Right. In a way it is, yes.
Yeah. Well, what then was the texture of Byzantine life? We're at the moment in the 6th century, but going forward for another 500 years, taking that large swatch of time, what's the nature of that civilization? If a civilization can be reduced to a few generalizations.
Well, we'll say then we're moving forward to about the 10th century, approximately. Well, politically, you have an autocracy that dominates the entire society, an autocracy headed by one individual who has a dual title, and he is literally in control of everything. He is, for example, not just the emperor, he's also the chief bureaucrat. So you're always, you know, you are continually confronted with his presence. Now, what the political situation might be, one of the meanings of Byzantine is often political chaos or continual replacement by coup d'etat and that
mm-hmm.
type of thing.
Yeah.
Now, that in fact did happen, but there's an interesting problem there, because the emperor was specifically and definitely believed to be chosen by God. Therefore, if you succeeded in overthrowing him, you were acceding to the will of God. Problem is, if you failed, because then you were not just a traitor, you were blaspheming. You had second-guessed God, which is not a good thing to do. And the punishment was more or less appropriate to that. But it was, the office was, it was fragile to the extent that anyone could try to overthrow you, but they had to succeed. There is no real dynasty until well into the 10th century. No feeling that because you are the son of the ruling emperor, we'll say, that you are automatically going to succeed. That was not, in fact, the case.
Who then becomes emperor? Whoever the troops favor?
Well, there are various mechanisms that allow the rule to be passed on. For example, the emperor would very often make a relative, a close relative, Caesar, which is to say kind of a junior emperor, and junior emperors were not uncommon at all. Another replacement might appear from somewhere. In the 10th century, the great aristocratic houses begin to become quite powerful, especially Greco-Armenian aristocratic houses and that type of thing. So you're always going to, on the one hand, there's fantastic power concentrated in that one individual, but it is fragile.
Of course, to flourish that way and to have fantastic power, you need an awful lot of wealth around that you can command. And people need to be bought off or satisfied with bread, lots of bread, and as well as circuses. What was the source of the wealth of the Byzantine Empire during its run over those high 500 years or so?
Wealth comes from the land. More land you have, the more wealth you have. At this time, trade or commerce, which is a significant source of wealth in our world, was not all that important. So Byzantium, by controlling especially Anatolia, present-day Turkey, the Balkans, Egypt was extremely important source of wealth because it was a supplier of grain for the, mm-hmm. for the entire Mediterranean region. Their wealth was in the large expanse of land they contained, that they controlled, and the taxes that came from that land.
Well, were they ripping off and seriously raiding their territories, or did they have a benign kind of rule over the distant portions of the empire? Were they good to the Egyptians?
Well, the people that are being taxed always think that the tax service is being,
yeah.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the interest of the government to not overtax, but obviously mistakes were made at certain times.
Egypt had been lost by that time to Islam in any event, so you're really talking about Anatolia, talking about part of the Balkans. Southern Italy was still at least partially controlled. The trade what Rob said is very true. Trade was by the way. The Byzantines at one point simply allowed Italian trading cities to control their trade, and this backfired on them because they chose one over another, and then you begin to get, for example, Venice had been long their chief trading partner, and when Venice was replaced by Genoa, the Venetians more or less set their mind to create something which eventually destroyed the city in 1204 when the Crusaders took it. But the Byzantines were not, but of course even the ancient Greeks were not that big on trade, oddly enough. They regarded it as dirty.
It seems to be the rule of history, even down to the present moment, that great or powerful civilizations, sooner or later, are challenged by other rising powerful civilizations. We were challenged by one which seems to have come a cropper, but now we anticipate that we are to be challenged by another, namely by the People's Republic of China, in the coming century. The great challenge to Byzantium, of course, was Islam. And it's just been mentioned for the first time only a moment ago. We've got some commercials coming. Then we need to ask, what was the nature of the encounter between Islam and Eastern Christendom? What were the consequences of that encounter? And we shall proceed in that direction directly after we pause for these words.
We now return to Extension 720 from WGN Radio Chicago. Now, here's Milton Rosenberg.
And we return to Dean Miller, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Rochester, Robert S. Nelson, Professor of Art History at the University of Chicago, and we return to Byzantium. It's interesting, I just ran across this fact. Justinian's successor is Heraclius, as you well know, and on the day that Heraclius is installed as emperor, Muhammad, at the age of 40, has the vision in which he is called by the archangel to recite. And he protests, "I cannot recite." But ultimately he does, and the words of the Quran begin to emerge from Muhammad. So there's the emergence of something which will be the ultimate challenge to Byzantium.
Absolutely.
In rather short order.
Yeah, the power of Islam, armed Islam, moving out of the Arabian Peninsula, nobody expected it. The tribes of North Arabia had been pretty much divided, either with allegiance to East Rome, to Byzantium, or allegiance to Persia. And suddenly there they were, this gigantic cavalry force that literally swept through the Middle East, reached Egypt, I think, within a matter of years, were in North Africa maybe 5 years later, and then 100 years later had crossed into Spain. Violent.
Where they stayed for some
where
300 or 400 years.
Until the 15th century, correct?
Stayed for much longer, yeah.
Yeah. Islam was the enemy then. It was the foe. And there never was, except on a couple of occasions, there never would be an armistice. It would be a state of perpetual war. Byzantium lost Syria-Palestine. It lost North Africa and Egypt. It held Anatolia just barely. Then there were Arab fleets that showed up to besiege Constantinople. There was, except in one small instance, there, as I say, there never was an arrangement with the Muslim power, whatever it might be, caliphate, except in one case. That was Cyprus, where for a while they ran a condominium. In other words, they both collected taxes.
It's curious, they're doing something of the same sort on Cyprus right now, aren't they?
Yeah, except
there's a division between Turkish and Greek Cyprus.
Correct, sir. That's it. Now, what the Byzantines were terribly afraid of was, of course, a war on two fronts. In other words, the powers from the steppes, from the various Turkic, Hunnic, Gothic, who knows what, Slavs, people out there, were could be just as deadly as Islam. But what you tried to do was to organize a situation where you did not fight on both fronts. So you tried to stabilize your front in Anatolia, and then you dealt in various ways with the people out on the steppes, the what were called the Turks, which is to say the Magyars. And then this particular reading comes from an emperor, Constantine VII, who was a great collector and scholar, not much of an emperor. In fact, he spent most of his life with his books while his father-in-law ran the empire. But this comes from what is called on the administration of the empire, and it deals with a people called the Pechenegs.
This dates to where?
10th century.
10th century.
10th century. And when the Pechenegs have taken their oaths on to the imperial agent according to their zakana, their law, he presents them with the imperial gifts and takes from among them as many friends as he sees fit, that's to say hostages, and he returns. Agreement must be made with them on this condition that wherever the emperor calls upon them, they are to serve him, whether among the Russians or among the Bulgarians or again against the Turks, that is the Magyars. For they are able to make war upon all of these, and as they have often come against them, are now regarded by them with dread. And this is clear from what follows. For once when the cleric Gabriel was dispatched by imperial mandate to the Turks and said to them, quote, the emperor declares that you are to go and expel the Pechenegs from their place and settle yourselves there. For in former days you used to be settled there yourselves, so that you may be near to my imperial majesty, and when I wish I may send and find you speedily. Then all of the chief men of the Turks cried aloud with one voice, quote, we are not putting ourselves on the track of the Pechenegs, for we cannot fight them, because their country is great and their people numerous, and they are the devil's brats. And do not say this to us again, for we do not like it. Close quote. And when spring is over, the Pechenegs cross to the far side of the Dnieper River and always pass their summer there, and so on. The Pechenegs were just one of these players. And you control them by gifts, by bribes, and occasionally by war, usually getting someone else to attack them.
Sounds like an eternal game.
Exactly so. And they were the Byzantines were expert at it, expert.
So they had some Byzantine skills, too.
Oh, yes, they did.
They were tricky. Their
diplomacy was high class.
Well, they hold out for a long time, don't they?
They hold out for a very long time. Gibbon wrote this book, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire,
indeed.
And the so-called decline took 1,000 years, and if the great American empire lasts for 1,000 years, well, that'll be quite
fine. Lots of people
are
surprised, who've heard of Gibbon and know that title, are surprised to learn that what he's talking about when it comes to the decline and fall of the Roman Empire is the decline and fall of Byzantium.
It really is. He
ends his book at 1453.
That's right. He goes all the way to the end. Byzantium managed to maintain itself against Islam for centuries. But once you move into the 13th and 14th and 15th centuries, it becomes surprisingly weak. And it's amazing in a way that it didn't fall earlier. But by the middle of the 15th century, the Ottoman state had become so powerful that it had surrounded Constantinople, and it was by then inevitable that it would fall.
Something we've left out of this account, though it's part of the same story, is the Crusades, is it not?
Another very complicated.
The early Crusades were essentially at the invitation of Byzantium, I think.
The first was, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. They were, and Byzantium hosted the Crusaders and facilitated their work, but there was this continual distrust between the Latins and the Greeks.
But they brought in this Western counterforce against Islam.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And that was convenient for Byzantium for a while.
Until they take the Crusaders invade and take Constantinople itself.
That, in hindsight, was the fatal mistake for both the West and Eastern Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
It removed the Eastern bulwark against Islam, fatally weakening the Byzantine Empire. Then it was inevitable that it would fall in the 15th century. And so that crusade was the fourth crusade. It was supposedly going to the Holy Land to fight the Muslims, and instead it shifted and sacked Constantinople in 1204.
We will come to the end, to the fall of New Rome to the Turks in 1453. That sad end of the story. Directly after we pause for these words.
Now, from Radio 720 WGN Chicago, this is Extension 720. Here's your host, Milton Rosenberg.
There's an interesting perspective here. Whenever you talk about great civilizations, they always, as far as up to this time, as far as we know, they rise, they have their day or their century in the sun, they decline. We've had many cyclic theorists of history. Back in antiquity, in classical antiquity, Polybius is one. Down to the present moment, almost present, Spengler was one. Certainly Arnold Toynbee saw the clash between civilizations as inevitable challenge and response and the decline of the older civilization in the face of the new one gathering strength. I don't know how much of a rule, of a broad rule of history that is, but it does in a way apply, does it not, to Byzantium? They spent their energy, they spent their wealth, they overextended. That may often be the source of the fall of great empires, that they overextend and can't really handle all the problems that they buy through that kind of ambition.
Well, the Ottoman state that was the last and the great enemy of Byzantium managed to unify its populace through religion, and through a system of imperial Ottoman control.
Where were they? Where did they come from? How did they rise?
They were a very small, insignificant state, city-state in Anatolia that began
Farther east?
West, toward the Aegean, toward the sea.
Oh, really?
And they managed to take control of other small states on the frontier with Byzantium.
Mm-hmm.
And to unify those people, and then to skip across the Hellespont, across the body of water,
yeah,
into Europe, and to begin taking parts of Europe and the Balkan countries. And so that as the 15th century opens, Byzantium, Constantinople, is surrounded by a Turkish Anatolia and a Turkish Europe and Thrace in the Balkans.
So it falls.
It falls.
Despite its famous fortifications.
Its great fortifications were built in the 5th century. They had survived countless sieges from Russians, from Muslims, from Palestine, from everywhere. They could not survive cannon.
Mm-hmm.
They were not built against for defense against gunpowder. And the Ottomans were in the technological avant-garde of being able to use cannon for siege warfare. So they trained their great cannons on the walls of Constantinople and began to tear them down.
So what happens to the remnant of Byzantine civilization? It's a way of life. It's a language. It's a basic religious tradition, as well as, we haven't talked about it, but a great artistic tradition, great musical tradition.
Culture,
what happens to all of that?
Well, it had transferred or been transferred. A scholar named Dmitry Obolensky talks about the Byzantine Commonwealth, and it's an excellent idea, excellent concept, because it had transferred and had radiated, especially into the Slavic lands, as far as Kiev and Rus, and even north of that, the conversion of the Russians that occurred already in the 10th century. Other peoples were converted as well. But it, along with the religion, went the Greek language, a degree of education, literacy.
The Greek language for the liturgy, but not for daily use.
Not for daily use. And then you have actually the conversion of those languages into a form of Greek alphabet with various, the so-called Cyrillic coming out of this. This radius, cultural radiation, simply allowed that empire to live on long past its, you know, its temporal limits.
And it lives to this day.
To this day.
Largely through Eastern Orthodoxy, would you say, or what else?
I think through Eastern Orthodoxy, yeah. Yeah, you have to say that. That tradition is extremely powerful. When the Greeks decided or thought that they could break away from the Ottoman Turks in the early 19th century, their vision was not a vision of ancient Greece. Their vision was a vision of Byzantium. It was a vision of that they wanted to have Constantinople back, and the folk songs and the general propaganda knew precisely what they wanted, but that did not sell in the West. It didn't sell to Lord Byron or whoever, the so-called Philhellenes, and therefore you pick up and you use the image of ancient Greece.
But Lord Byron went to fight in their war, and he died there, didn't he?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
So would it be the case that the present contest or lasting hostility between Greece and Turkey is in a way a continuation of the struggle between Byzantium and the Ottoman Empire?
In many ways it is. Ataturk was the great unifier of the Turkish people in the demise of the Ottoman Empire after World War I. And he led the Turkish forces against the Greek armies that were attempting to reestablish Byzantium. They were attempting to make Constantinople again, to switch Istanbul back to Constantinople, and to take considerable parts of Anatolia, present-day Turkey, and make that part of the Greek state. Ataturk rallied the Turkish forces and pushed the Greek armies into the sea, into the Aegean.
We've said nothing so far, Robert, about the area in which you specialize, namely art history.
Mm-hmm.
What is the Byzantine tradition in art, and how has it come to us? What is its effect upon the things and the representations that surround us in Western life?
Well, to continue this theme of the afterlife of Byzantium, the principal artistic expression, religious artistic expression in Byzantium was the icon, which continues in Eastern Orthodox churches. And any of our listening audience would visit any Orthodox church in Chicago, you'll see versions of Byzantine icons right there today here in Chicago.
You can also find them in little shops in their Russian form.
That's right.
There's a in one of the downtown vertical malls, there is a Russian shop which sells modern versions of iconography.
Mm-hmm. And they're based on the iconography, and the style, the way of painting that the Byzantines were practicing in the 14th and 15th century. And it's as if that form of painting was frozen in time and continues to the present day.
What was the musical tradition? Was it basically in the in liturgical settings, or do we have it represented elsewhere in contemporary life?
Well, there were popular songs, there were lots of folk songs and things like this. The liturgical music was very rich, and that survives also in the Greek Orthodox Church today.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different musical. I'm not a musical expert. I'm not a musicologist, but it's a different tonal system that we're accustomed to hearing in Western music and Western church music. But it's very powerful, and when you listen to a church choir singing these beautiful hymns, it really is quite magical. And in fact, we understand from Russian sources that this was one of the main reasons that the Russians decided to convert to Orthodoxy. The Russian ruler sent an emissary to Constantinople in the 10th century, and the Byzantine emperor promptly took those ambassadors to St. Sophia, and they attended the church service there, and were so impressed with the beauty of the church and the incense and the music and the vestments and the liturgy that they went back home to Kiev and told the ruler there that it's as if they saw heaven on earth there, and for that reason the emissaries advocated that the Russian ruler should convert to Orthodoxy, not to Catholicism or not to Islam.
It contrasts to the story, mythic or otherwise, about the king of the Khazars, who supposedly, and this is about the 8th century, isn't it?
He converted to Judaism.
Yeah. Converts to Judaism.
Yeah, that was their upper class had all converted to Judaism.
Yeah.
Not least because what this did was to hold them clear both of Islam on the one side and Eastern Orthodoxy on the other.
Uh-huh.
The ordinary Khazar, I don't think, was Jewish, but certainly the upper class and the ruling class was, and that lasted, I believe, a couple centuries.
Possibly. Well, there are those around who favor the theory, though it's generally been discredited, the theory that was put forward in popular form by Arthur Koestler in his book The 13th Tribe, who argues that most modern Ashkenazic Jews are descended from the Khazars rather than from the people of ancient Palestine.
Well,
but there's apparently nothing to that, but it's been a popular hypothesis at times.
The Khazars were used by the emperor as a bodyguard. Turks very often were before the hiring of the Scandinavians and, mm-hmm. and Anglo-Saxons mm-hmm. and so on in the 11th century. Khazars were used, I think, for several hundred years, but they were specifically pagan and Turk,
yeah.
and they were kept that way in order to serve as a more effective bodyguard for the emperor. And before that, other Turks were used as well.
There no civilization is wholly lost and disappears, I think. Great civilizations always radiate in all directions, and the world is different for their having risen and fallen than it would otherwise be.
Absolutely. I mean, the great civilizations always face foes, face armies that are challenging them, and If they succeed, they manage to incorporate those invading armies into that civilization so that the Mongols attacking China become Chinese,
mm-hmm.
the Mongols attacking Persia become Persian, mm-hmm. The Turks attacking Byzantium did not become Byzantines. That's the difference.
Well, there was the original conqueror, Mehmed Fatih, remember, Muhammad the Conqueror, attempted for a time. It is now believed, this is still arguable, attempted for a time to form a Turco-Greek empire. He mm-hmm. attempted to do
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
We have the evidence that it was at least attempted, but it did not succeed. I think it lasted for maybe a generation, and then gradually you had the assumption of complete Muslim
yeah.
And Turkic power. But it was an idea in his head that he should become a Turkish emperor of Byzantium, of East Rome.
Hmm. We pause another round of commercials, and it is time to invite telephone calls. Any question you would like to raise, any expertise you'd like to share, and for that matter, if you draw much of your understanding of these matters from your own ethnic connection, and we have lots of people from the eastern part of Christendom living in Chicago, we'd love to hear from you and love to have your questions and or your comments. 591-7200 is the number, 591-7200, though I've barely scratched the surface with the questions I've been able to ask, and your questions are more than welcome. Get them in right now, please, if you would. 591-7200, and we return after these words.
Now, from Radio 720 WGN Chicago, this is Extension 720. Here's your host, Milton Rosenberg.
Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, now Constantinople, been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, now Constantinople, so if you've a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul. Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say.
People just liked it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone, Constantinople.
Istanbul is Constantinople now, or should be Constantinople. That seems to be the theme. We went looking for this. I remembered a record by Eartha Kitt singing this. It wasn't in our library, but this performance of the same by the group called They Might Be Giants. Does it represent some sort of continuing longing on the part of Greeks to retake Constantinople or to reestablish Constantinople?
Well, I think it probably does. It's a very catchy tune. I think of it sort of personally. I once gave a very large lecture at UCLA, and
mm-hmm.
I got ready to give my lecture, and all of a sudden the graduate students in the office in the audience put this record on and
they did.
Blasted out all over the auditorium, and so it was a very nice introduction to this problem of how how Constantinople becomes Istanbul and how this Byzantine civilization becomes an Ottoman civilization.
You know, I've never been to Istanbul. Is it still a swinging town?
I don't know about swinging.
fascinating place.
It's a fascinating place. I've been there. The only problem with being there at certain times of the year is the problem of an Islamic presence that has become more and more more sharp and to a certain extent can make you uncomfortable. I remember I was there in 1967, and I saw an individual wearing a green turban as a sign that he'd been on the Hajj. Now, that's against the law in Turkey. And as soon as I saw that, I thought this is...
The government there still struggles against Islamic fundamentalism. It's one of the few in the Islamic world that is militant against fundamentalism, apparently.
It's a secular state, and it worships the army specifically, worships Ataturk.
Yeah.
And if when you go there, you would think that he had died yesterday rather than 1938. Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary.
It is time to go to the phones. 591-7200, the number. If you're trying to reach us, you're not getting through. All the lines are taken, but do persist and call again right after we said goodnight to some prior caller. And here is the first. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
I was a medieval history student at Southern Illinois, and we were taught that Constantine used Christianity to unite the pagan empire at the time, and that he presided over and directed the conclusions of the Nicene Councils. I was interested in, do you think that, we also were taught that he was a pagan until he died, pretty much until then. Do you think that any of those pagan influences had any, and his decisions have any influence on present-day doctrine in Christianity?
Well, Christianity is a religion of the Roman Empire, and it's the language of the scriptures. The Bible is Greek, and the words that are used to express ideas about the deity are pre-Christian words and pre-Christian philosophical concepts. So it's part and parcel of the Roman world, the religion is.
Well, I think the Jews would disagree with that, but even though they were conquered by Rome. But I was thinking as far as the actual idea of Christ being a man or a god, didn't you think that some of his own pagan ideas might have had something to do with how it turned out, rather than, because it doesn't seem to fit with Greek scripture?
Well, the search for the historical Jesus has been going on for over 200 years and still, I think, confounds almost all of those searchers, despite the claims that they make. We don't know what the historical Jesus, unless we are fundamentalists, which I think no one at this table is, we really remain in the dark as to what the historical Jesus really believed about himself. But it is interesting that you find in the early history of Byzantium, and in the early history of Christianity generally, to be sure, you find so much argument and controversy over the interpretation of Jesus. Quite apart from Arianism that we've talked about, and monophysitism, there is the Christian Gnosticism, which also, as I understand it, took the position that Jesus was an elevated and enlightened and perfected human, but also denied his absolute divinity, his absolute oneness with the Father and the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, well, a Gnostic, by definition, would have to reject the idea of any contamination by the flesh, right? And the Byzantines continued to have a Gnostic presence right through, I believe, the 12th or 13th century. Paulicians, other groups who had to be literally defeated. They had a stronghold at one point on the border between Syria and Anatolia. They had to be defeated and were then subject to a process that they use quite frequently, which is transfer populations. They transferred them to the Balkans, where they then began to become something called Bogomils, and eventually that seems to have led to the phenomenon of the purified ones, the Cathari in southern France. A long tradition there of that.
Theology, an old friend of mine was given to say, is really a wonderful art form.
It's also enormously complex. And then we think about these great debates in the early church about the nature of Christ, whether he's God, whether he's man, whether what part of that equation where you reside in that. It seems very abstruse to us, very very learned and hopelessly abstract. But in our own day, Christians have enormous debates over other issues of our day that are very primal or very basic. And I'm thinking of the issue of abortion. When does humanity begin? We have enormous debates about this. And if you can sort of put yourself back at a time when Christianity hadn't resolved a whole series of things that are important for us today, you get some feel for that tension.
Yes, very interesting point. Back to the phones, 591-7200. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Bill. Thank you again for another great program.
Thank you, sir.
There was a great chain that was winched across the harbor to stop enemy warships during time of war. Do your historians have any idea of the size of the links?
I'm sure they do. Dean Miller?
I can take a guess. It was a huge chain across the mouth of the Golden Horn. I believe that I seem to recall reading descriptions saying that each link was about the size of a human. Forged out of bronze. And so you're talking about approximately a 5-foot link. It was an immensely heavy thing. The Turks got around it in 1453 by hauling the cannon overland, and ships for that matter, hauling them over the into the Golden Horn so they could attack the city from the other side.
Yes, I've read that. Now, in order to lift that in water, they must have had it partially floated or something, maybe just enough floats under it so that it would sink and then winch it up when they needed it.
I do not know the technology there at all. Absolutely not.
Well, thank you very much.
We thank you, sir. Mm-hmm. I think we've heard from an engineer who's trying to bring his expertise to an understanding of history. 591-7200, the number, and the next caller. Good evening.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm enjoying your show very much, by the way. I just wanted to ask, since the development of Turkey as a nation, has it contributed significantly in any way to civilization? Are there, a number of ways in which one could say, well, the Turkish culture is very significant in that it's contributed this to, civilization, whether militaristic or in any other way?
Well, of course, one can ask about the Ottoman Empire just as one asks about the Byzantine Empire. What did it leave to mankind generally?
Well, I think being an art historian, especially about Ottoman art, which is absolutely magnificent, the great mosques of Istanbul with their splendid minarets, and especially the beautiful tiles which covered the insides of the major mosques and the Ottoman palace there. Beautiful manuscripts with lovely miniatures in them. There was once a stunning show of Suleiman the Magnificent in his age at the Art Institute downtown a few years ago, which gives you a really good sense of the artistic accomplishments.
Mm-hmm. Is that really a Turkish development, or isn't that more just Arabic in general?
Well, it's made by artists in the Ottoman Empire. It builds upon prior Islamic traditions that go back to the 7th century.
Of course, when you ask about Turkish accomplishments, one has to note as well that they may well have perpetrated the first significant genocide in this century, unless you want to attribute that to Leopold of the Belgians. But the Turkish slaughter of Armenians by now is fully authenticated as a dreadful event in the history of this century. And that remains another great source of conflict. The Ottoman Empire no longer exists. Not only are Greeks angry at the Turks, but so are the Armenians. Though there is still a large Armenian population, I suppose, in modern Turkey, is there not?
Not very much in modern Turkey, no. In 1915, they pretty much were removed
or moved either back
into the Caucasus, back into the old Armenian homeland, or removed to what is now Syria.
Yeah. 591-7200 is our number. We've had, at least on one occasion, I think twice, we've had debates between representatives of the Armenian and the Turkish position on the question of the historicity of the slaughter of the Armenians, and I know that it still is a contested issue. 591-7200, as we go to the next caller, and here is that caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, another thing along ethnic lines. In the biblical times, there were the Galatians in the, somewhere in Anatolia,
yeah,
St. Paul's epistle.
Yeah.
And supposedly a Celtic people. And did they hang around to Byzantine times, and what happened to them?
The Galatians were a Celtic people?
Yeah, right. There were Gauls. I don't believe they did, but Anatolia is such a soup, such a mix, a stew of nationalities and ethnic groups. It is perfectly possible that some could have, in an isolated area, in the same way that in Galicia, the other end of the Mediterranean, you have a people that define themselves as having descended from a Celtic group in northern Spain. I have no indication. I don't recall anything about this.
Yeah, you don't know any more than I do.
That's about it,
yeah.
Right. I don't think it's there to know. I think that they had disappeared.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Interesting contribution. And quickly to another 591-7200. Good evening. You are on the air.
Hello, Milton Guests.
Yes, sir.
You've spoken quite a bit about the differences in the doctrine early on between the Roman and the Constantinople Church. How have those differences shaken out to the present time? What are those differences now?
That's quite a good question, a valuable one. I still don't understand filioque and the difference between the two churches on that issue. Is that still a crucial issue?
Well, I'm not a theologian, obviously not a priest. It's my understanding that the relations between the two churches are much more harmonious now. I believe it was Pope John the 23rd who began the rapprochement with the Orthodox Church and went to Istanbul and greeted and kissed the Orthodox Patriarch, therefore making up from this very long dispute. And it's my understanding that relations have very much improved in the
last... But are there any doctrinal obstacles to their reunification?
I believe there are.
Oh, that there were married priesthood, for one. Your Orthodox or Eastern Orthodox priest is allowed to marry.
Well, there's a division of the Roman Catholic Church in which the same is true, the Maronites.
Well, but they're one of the old Monophysite groups who have allied themselves to Rome. They've united themselves. They're a uniate church. The bishopric, on the other hand, is in Eastern Orthodoxy, is celibate. So there is a question of married clergy. There still are doctrinal questions, but they're mainly... they're not so much, I think, in Greek Orthodoxy as they are in some of the other some of the other branches. Eastern Orthodoxy is extremely easy to break off and break away and set yourself up as autocephalous, which is to say, headed by your own patriarch, metropolitan, or whatever.
So the Patriarch of Constantinople, the present one, does not really tightly command the whole Orthodox Church.
No, and he never did. He never did.
He doesn't have the same kind of centrality that the Pope does over Roman Catholicism.
Absolutely true.
Yeah. Sir, thank you.
Well, doesn't that say something about the infallible power of the Pope in the Church? Isn't that one of the major differences that they therefore have?
It is indeed a major difference.
And the Orthodox would reject the claim to infallibility for the Bishop of Rome.
It would reject the notion of the primacy of Rome.
Yeah.
Correct.
We thank you, sir. And we will quickly go to another. I should say that if you're trying to get through and not reaching us, or if you're very far away and would like to be a contributor to the program, you have the other alternative, namely to reach us via email. And you do that by going to the address extension720@tribune.com. Extension 720, one word, @tribune, TRIBUNE.com. If you're on another continent or on the other side of the Rockies and you want to be in touch, that's the way to get right through, and we read those as they come in. 591-7200 is the number. You are next. Good evening.
Yes, sir. Milton, very interesting program tonight, and a couple of comments about your ancestral homeland and mine, which is the Ukraine.
Yes.
The guest tonight spoke of a Russian presence in the 9th and 10th century. Every history I read about the... area shows that Kiev was the original outpost of the Romans, which became part of the Byzantine Empire and was founded by the Ukrainians, who invited Vladimir and Olga, who were Varangian Vikings, to rule them because they couldn't rule themselves, basically. They accepted and they became Christianized, became Orthodox, basically. Actually, they were Catholic because there was no Orthodoxy, but when they were there in the 9th century, the true Russians, as you call it, never developed till the 12th century, when one branch of Vladimir and Olga's family, over the generations afterwards, moved to Moscow area and became the Muscovy dynasty. And there was a lot of intermarriage with the Tartars at the time. So if you follow your lineage, the Ukrainians were basically the original Rus, R-U-S, and the Muscovite dynasty came about much later. And they, just like if you say if you scratch a Spaniard, you'll find Jewish blood, or if you scratch a Russian, you'll find Tartar blood. That's basically the historical intermix there.
Well, you've absolutely got me.
Okay, and then the other...
I couldn't possibly agree or disagree. I don't know enough about it. Gentlemen, do you want to judge that reconstruction of history?
Our listeners is correct. Mm-hmm. This is the general progression from the state of Rus, R-U-S, in Kiev, to use a neutral word, and then the creation of the great duchy of Russia in up in Moscow in the after Byzantium.
Right. Milton, the other thing I wanted to bring up is you've talked very well over about the years about the Holocaust and the Armenian slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
But the great slaughter of all time, which is hardly ever spoken of, is what Stalin did to 14 million Ukrainians in the 30s and 40s.
Ah, we've talked about that also.
Oh, I must
14 million is a rather high estimate, I think. Robert Conquest, the British historian,
that's right, I've got the book.
Done the most with that, estimates between 8 and 9 million exterminated.
No, I've got the book. He estimates between 1930 all the way to 1948. He's including the ones they killed after the war.
Well, yes,
too.
If you go to 1948. But the starvation of the Ukrainians in the early 1930s, the estimate is
varies from
4 million to 7 million.
And you know who broke that story, by the way? A Chicago American reporter. Because the American diplomats who were all Stalin's drinking buddies were covering it up over there. But a Chicago American reporter.
They didn't all. Walter Duranty was somewhat guilty. He was the New York Times man at the time.
Right.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Glad to have heard from you.
Okay, bye-bye.
591-7200 is the number. As we go to the next, hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Milton.
Yes, sir.
Fascinating tonight. I've got...
In what way is this night different from all other nights?
Well, I listen to you quite frequently, and one of the things I'm getting into now, I'm into the Peloponnesian Wars.
Ah, yes.
And I'm studying my way up.
You're reading Thucydides?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm having a little tough time with it. If you guys got any suggestions...
Try him in English rather than Greek.
Definitely.
I'm trying him in English now. The main comment I had is that in the destruction of the Roman Empire, which led to the split... I read Brooks Adams' book from the turn of the century on the failure of societies, greed, concentration of power, and the fear. And at one time, according to Adams, he's talking about Rome as his model, economic model, where the people would go into debt to the owners of the property and end up having their property confiscated because of the usury rates on interest, and then they would become slaves because they couldn't pay the debt, and their children would become slaves. And this is one of the things that Brooks Adams is talking about, where the political leaders in Rome got so carried away with their own power, similar to what happened when Cromwell went and took over the House of Lords. And I was wondering if you fellows would like to comment on that or expand on it for a poor, ignorant, blue-collar guy. And my last comment is, I'm looking for a quotation. I can't find it. Maybe somebody can help me. There's an old thing I was taught by a teacher in high school, something to the effect that if we don't study history, we're doomed to repeat the blunders of our past.
Oh, that's a quotation from George Santayana. It's a quotation.
George Santayana?
Yeah, it's so often... repeated that it's become something of a cliche.
Where can I find more on George Santayana?
Oh, any book on modern philosophy or history of philosophy will, or just go look up Santayana himself, either on the internet or in a library.
Because I would like to get, I want to make a little plaque. I believe in this. If you study history, you can hopefully prevent yourself from repeating the blunders. And I'd like to some comments on maybe, I know I'm going back and trying to lay a foundation of understanding the Peloponnesian Wars and how it led up to the formation of Rome.
Well, the Peloponnesian War is an interesting war. It's an interesting clash of cultures.
Yep.
But these are both Greek cultures. It's essentially Athens and Sparta, gentlemen.
And when Athens...
Hold on a minute, sir. Let's begin to get some response.
Sure.
Well, other than the fact that Athens, which up to that time had dominated Greece and very specifically, and then... from that time on until the time of Alexander, it was simply collapsed into itself, was defeated in the war, and never really achieved anything of any significance after that, except in the realm of thought and culture, which is obviously important.
Yeah, well, the thing that got me when you were talking, what got my attention, was you were talking about the Sicilians being allowed to trade and how Athens attempted to take Sicily, and because of that, of the failures there, began their employment.
Well, sir, I must interrupt because we're late for
fine.
Some commercials.
I thank you for your time. I thank you for the overindulgence, too.
Not at all. I'm glad to have heard from you. Glad for that enthusiasm. We've got some commercials coming, and then we'll be directly back to the phones on 591-7200.
Now, from Radio 720 WGN Chicago, this is Extension 720. Here's your host, Milton Rosenberg.
And we add on a little sort of commercial for ourselves that I recorded a while ago, and we will be playing it on and off to acquaint you with something new that's available to you and that we want you to take advantage of. And a brief special word from the proprietor of the store. Did you know that we have established something that we are calling the Extension 720 Forum? It's on our web page, and on it and in it, our listeners are opining about topics that have arisen on the program or yet other matters. We'd love to have you join in the forum. You find it by simply going to WGNradio.com and then going to Extension 720 and then clicking on Forum, and you'll be there, and all the rest will be explained by the instructions that you read. Do come on in and join us. We're establishing an electronic community of WGN listeners. And back to real live talk, and continuing for just a moment, on that same page, our webpage on the WGN site, you'll also find now archived at least one recent program. In fact, the one that we did with Senator George Mitchell. And a few other such programs will be showing up shortly, available in sound archive, so that if you've got real audio, you can replay them or introduce other friends to them. In fact, we'd love to have your recommendations about programs that we have done that you would like to see archived. You can put them in on that forum that I just talked about, or you can communicate with us, of course, directly on our own website, extension720@tribune.com, extension720@tribune.com. Gentlemen, an email that I think you'll find interesting. The listener says, as an Irish Catholic, I was rather startled when I married my Greek wife. The ceremony, surrounded by icons of gold in the light of stained glass and clouds of burning incense. I felt like the Russian emissaries mentioned earlier on the program. The wedding ceremony reached back to the 4th century. After the wedding, one of my Baptist friends said to me, "Boy, you are so married now." It was quite an experience. They don't call it Orthodox for nothing.
That's terrific. Enormous sort of appreciation of the role and the power of ceremony, which Byzantium manipulated and used to its effect for a long time.
I was at a Greek Orthodox church in town once some years ago on, wasn't Christmas, I think it was the...
Probably Easter.
The Easter, the that's Orthodox great. Easter.
That's the most important holiday.
It was indeed. Mm-hmm. Very beautiful and very overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And incense is very important. Actually, incense... Dean and I have a colleague who's writing a book about the history of incense.
Yes, that's
it's a very interesting subject, and it comes in with the beginning of Christianity and its incorporation into church services.
Back to the phones, and here is the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I really enjoy your program. It's always a treat to listen to you. Say, could you tell me if there are some books, if you or your aunt of the guests there might know of some books you might recommend on Byzantium? I had read a condensed version of a multi-volume set, but it was more of a description of the reigns of each of the emperors than an overview of their entire culture. And I wonder if you might have some books you might recommend.
I would think one such book might well be the book by Dean Miller, one of our guests, namely the Byzantine Tradition.
Okay.
I'll never find it.
No?
They've both been out of print for years.
Well,
the library will have it, yeah. Sure. Or Imperial Constantinople, if you want to check that one out.
Okay.
What would you recommend that is available for general readers?
I think one of our best writers is Sir Stephen Runciman.
Uh-huh.
Wonderfully literate writer. And he has a book, I believe it's still in print, called Byzantine Civilization.
Correct. It's still in print.
Another person I would recommend would be Cyril Mango, another English historian. He has a book called about Rome, a general book about Byzantium. I can't remember the title exactly.
Wasn't there a book a few years ago by a guy named Norwich or Norwich or something
yes.
like that?
Yes,
Julian Norwich, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. He's not a Byzantine scholar. Doesn't matter. He wrote a book that I think was well received. And there's no reason why you shouldn't attack the problem that way.
What is its title? Something like A History of Byzantium. It's pretty.
I think it's pretty simple. Yeah.
Right.
Julian Norwich, Norwich, will get you that title. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Valuable question. Always a good question. 591-7200, and you are next on the air. Good evening.
Yes, good evening. Thank you again for another marvelously illuminating program. I was wondering about one institution of Byzantine civilization that hasn't been discussed, and that's castration. My understanding of it is it was instituted, one, to eliminate the possibility of sexual intrigue on the part of bureaucrats and officials, and also to eliminate any desire for dynastic ambition on their part. And wasn't Belisarius a eunuch? Perhaps you can illuminate us on that.
No, Belisarius was not, but the other great general of Justinian, Narses, was a eunuch.
Mm-hmm.
The Byzantines had a parallel bureaucracy, which was the eunuch bureaucracy. They were called the Avarvati, the beardless ones. Now, some of these people were actually what we would call complete eunuchs. Others were not. And those others could marry, adopt children. It was a fascinating kind of parallel organization there. And they were used, again, there could be no dynastic difficulties with them. They could not, and for that matter, as they were mutilated, they could not rise in the ecclesiastical hierarchy either. They were used. It was something that it was not unlikely to be encountered anywhere in the East, and any of the great Hellenistic kingdoms would have eunuchs. It was not just to guard the harem or anything like that. There was a reason for it. That did not, in fact, cease in the Western world until the late 19th century. But that would be specifically for musical.
You mean the castrati?
The castrati
tenors
and their
and sopranos.
Super tenors, if you've ever heard of them.
Sort of male sopranos.
Handel engaged one for one of his operas, didn't he? Performed in London.
I wouldn't be at all surprised. The only one time I heard a record made in the very very early 20th century of the last castrato of the Sistine Choir, and I can tell you that is a strange voice, very strange voice.
Well, you still get that in the modern reproduction of ancient music. With counter tenors singing that way.
It's different.
Yeah, but they're singing that music.
Oh, they're singing that music. Yeah.
We thank you, sir, for the call. Did one enter voluntarily into the ranks of the castrati of Byzantium, or was that enforced?
I assume it was enforced. It doesn't sound like something one would do voluntarily.
I would think not.
I suspect some of them were imported from other parts of the world, as were slaves generally.
Then it was a culture which certainly had a very cruel side.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. I mean, you have to realize in such societies, you need to have groups of people that are close to the emperor or the ruler that are in some way distant from social relations in that society.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had Scandinavian guards, they had Anglo-Saxon guards from England, different groups and power oftentimes bring in people from very far away to become the sort of loyal palace guard.
Didn't the successor Turks, the Ottomans, do essentially the same thing with their janissaries, so-called?
That's right, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
These were foreign men brought in.
Brought in Christians who were taken by the Devshirme, the child tribute, and were brought to Constantinople and either brought up as janissaries in the military or brought up in the bureaucracy, one way or another.
So you don't get in either of these civilizations what you got so often in late Rome, namely the Palladian Guard, the Palatine Guard.
Praetorian Guard,
struggling, knocking over the emperors.
I don't know. I think coup d'etat or attempts to, or successful or not, to replace the emperor usually came from powerful figures around him, not from the bodyguard.
Yeah. Well, some of the early emperors are murdered by the Praetorian Guard, are they not?
In Rome, yes.
In Rome,
yeah. Well, that's how Claudius got in, for one. Mm-hmm. I can't think of others, but...
Moscow. According to Robert Graves. An interesting side note we might make. The great poet who did those early historical novels and did the I. Claudius novels also did a novel about Belisarius, the great general of Justinian whom we've been talking about.
Count Belisarius, right. He got some of his information from a historian called named Procopius.
And yeah.
A historian in the 6th century, Procopius wrote voluminously on the history of the empire and on Justinian, and then wrote what they called the Anecdota, the secret history, in which he put in all the good stuff.
Quickly, another call or two. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, good evening. Interesting program, as often.
Go ahead, sir.
My question pertains to the possible comparison or contrast with the Western versus Eastern Christendom, and of course, therefore, the Byzantine Empire. With respect to the Inquisition, in the West, you had hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, eliminated for so-called heresy and witchcraft, many of whom by the most excruciating possible means. And you had indeed, often the church would actually do the sentencing, but then foist the responsibility for the deed upon the state. How did it work in the East insofar as there was any parallel at all?
I don't believe there is a parallel.
Mm-hmm.
There was a problem with heresy in the East, and the state would get involved with it, but there was nothing as systematic in the East.
I have nothing to add. No, there is no parallel that I know of. Heresy was a problem, and it was dealt with in various ways. Sometimes, as I already said, you have heretical groups who were specifically groups and who were then removed from one part of the empire to another part.
We thank the caller, and I think we won't take any more calls. Time is too short to give them proper treatment. I've been wondering all night, Dean Miller, when in your years of service at the University of Rochester, were you ever a dean?
Never.
Why would
Yossarian, major. No,
yeah,
I avoided
exactly.
That. Yes, I avoided that.
I should have thought there would have been a movement there to make you a dean.
There may have been, but
I
resisted it, I can tell you.
This has been a delightful conversation and very informative indeed. Say a word very quickly. We only have a moment or two left about the work that you're directly engaged in at the moment.
I'm trying to write a book about the life of the Church of Hagia Sophia and some of these quotations that I read tonight, and something I've been thinking about a long time. Both the life of the church in the Middle Ages and also how it becomes a cultural symbol in our modern day.
Mm-hmm. That's what Robert Nelson is working on. And Dean Miller?
People are trying to get me to do a life of Constantine the Great, and I'm resisting this. But if I live, as I said to Rob earlier on, if I live another 30 years, I might give it a shot.
Mm-hmm. He must be a fascinating and kind of an exhaustible subject.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't think he's ever been treated quite right.
Well, my thanks again for two fine scholars who've given us a fine discussion tonight. Dean Miller, Professor Emeritus of History at Rochester, University of Rochester. Robert S. Nelson, Professor of Art History at the University of Chicago. Quick words about programs to come. Tomorrow night, during the first hour, we'll be visiting with former Vice President Dan Quayle. During the second hour, we'll be talking with Alan Carlson of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society.